Movies in this country are mostly about entertainment and about commercial profit. But film can also educate while it entertains, remind us of our cultural roots, and bridge gaps between cultures. I'm Susan McGinnis, and this is Conversations. My guest today is Paul Anders Sima. His people are the Sami people, people that most of the world think of as Laplanders. Paul Sima was the first Sami to go to Swedish film school and created the first film in the Sami language. Paul, the Sami people number about 50,000 total in the world, and among them speak four fairly distinct languages. When you chose to set Beyond Day and Night in the Sami language, did you do so purposefully because so few people would be able to speak it?
No, I didn't. First of all, we have one major dialect. It's about 30,000 people who speak the Sami language. And I decided to make this film in our own language because in Europe we are quite used to use subtitles. So even if I made the film in the Sami language, it was possible for other people to see it also. In fact, it was more effective than using Swedish, because if I had used only Swedish as dialogue, then the film has just been broadcasted in Sweden. But by using the Sami language, it has also been broadcasted in Finland and in Norway, and also in Russia, where they speak the same language.
And it also allows viewers, it seemed to me, to pay attention to the sounds they would hear if they were listening to a Sami conversation.
Yes, of course, that's an important part of the film. Until now, films about the Samis, or the Laps, as we are also called by the majority, have always been done by people from the outside. They have always come into our culture and made films about us, and they have told about our people, our dreams, our wishes, our hopes. So this was the first time someone from the inside could make a film. So I thought it was a good idea to make it in our own language, so the viewers also could see or hear what it sounded like.
I have heard that you have said that the Sami as a people are oriented to the visual and the auditory. Does that make film an especially good medium for you as well as for your people?
Yes. Our writing language is very young. It's just about 20 years ago when people started to write books in the Sami language. So our language is, and our culture is very oral, and our culture is also very visual. So we don't write a lot. We speak, and the life of the Samis is out on the big white tundra. So
yes.
So when you can't, if you're going to speak to people, you have to shout. So instead, you can. Our culture is you show things. It's more important to act and to do things than to speak.
Yeah.
So that is the reason that the film making is very close to our culture, and I believe that the old shamans in our culture, who were the people who told stories in the old days, if they had known about this fantastic media that is coming up, filmmaking, telling in pictures and in sound, they had been very, very happy, and I'm sure that they had been making films.
This a shaman, it seems to me, creates an atmosphere, creates a mood. Is that also a part of filmmaking from your perspective?
Yes. Our shamans in the old time, they, in the winter when it was cold in December, when it was very dark, they collected the tribe into a tent where there was a fire in the middle, and people eat and they drank, and then the shaman let the fire burn out, and it became dark, and then he started a performance that was almost like a film. He started to drum, and he could make noises, sounds outside the tent, and he made his tricks so that the people could experience something that was, I believe, very close to a film.
Is that also how stories were told, legends and myths were passed on?
Yes, it was a kind of a theater performance where the shaman was the storyteller,
yeah.
But he also made big drama of it. It wasn't just a story told to the listeners it was also a play, almost like a theater play. Mm. And I have also seen the dresses of our shamans. It was, they had different bells, small pieces of reindeer bone and bone from birds and reindeer horns, and with these instruments he could make different sounds. And when you are sitting in the darkness in a tent on the tundra and the wind is blowing and you can hear the different animals outside the tent, and when you use these small bells and bones, you can really let people's fantasies go start to move when you tell an interesting story.
What a rich way.
It is.
Ooh, sounds wonderful. Yeah. This is Paul Sima. He is a film director and a script writer from Sweden. His people are the Sami people, as we've said before, people that people still in around the world think of as Laplanders. The film Beyond Day and Night tells a legend. The grandfather tells a story to his grandson that is one of the, I understand, major legends of your people. Can you tell it briefly? It's about bounty and why the bounty is taken away.
Yes. I can shortly tell about why I made the film. When I was a kid growing up in a town that is almost like Fairbanks, it's called Karesuando. It's in the very far north of Sweden, on the border to Finland. When I was a kid and when I went to school, my Swedish teachers always told to me that the Sami culture is it's a very primitive culture. They told me that the Sami language was going to disappear in 5 or 10 years. And I always heard in school that the things I had learned at home was of no value in the modern life we were living in that time. And for some time I also believed that my own culture is of no value, until I met my grandfather, who was living on the tundra, and he started to tell me all these fantastic stories, and I discovered that it isn't right. I discovered all the very nice things and the important qualities of the Sami culture, and that's the reason I started to make the film. I thought that, listen, our culture is existing in one of the hardest environments in the world. It's very cold and it's very dark. My people has been living there for hundreds of years before no whites could even come and live there. And they could do it without destroying the nature. They could live in the cold and on the tundra without destroying and stealing from the future generations. So I thought, what are the qualities of my culture? What were the qualities of my ancestors' life that made it possible for them to live in this environment where nobody else could do? So that was the reason I started to do this film. It was also kind of a research for myself about my own background.
And you started with the theme of a grandfather and a boy, in this case a boy who comes from the city fairly cocky and thinking his grandfather is old and washed up and hasn't done anything important.
Yes.
And of course learns through the film that what his grandfather has to say is terribly important.
That's true. And I think a lot of young Samis, and I think also kids from native cultures all around the world today, are having the same background as I have. That everywhere in the world where I have visited native people, they have always had the same. They have been treated in the same way, and not only the native people, but also minorities. I have very good friends in France that are Brittany or Basque, and they have been telling me the same stories. So this film has been traveling all around the world. And it has been viewed in very many different countries and cultures. And I have been very worried in the beginning that how could someone in France, for example, understand this film? But I have got very positive feedback from people, and they have said, listen, this is a story about my village in Bretagne or in Basque country.
And here in Alaska as well.
Yes.
Have you, this is a personal question, and you can tell me you don't care to answer it, but has it made you very angry to discover that what you were taught in school, that your people are dying, your language will disappear, your culture is less than useful, is not true, that you spent so many years thinking that you were vestigial?
Of course it made me very angry, and it made me even more angry that when I discovered that I've been that this is a lie, that it's not true. And I think it's for my own point of view, I think I lost very many years believing that the things I thought I learned at home was of no value. I think this, it would be very important that the schools around the world, that they could accept the different backgrounds the kid has when they comes to school and starts to build the education on the qualities they come with, and instead of trying to tear it down and to destroy. And I think that's maybe one of the reasons we see so many people in minority cultures that have problems with their identity, and this leads to alcoholism, to drug abuse, and it's the reason is that their proudness as human beings is teared down, and I think this is very bad.
If my culture is dying, then I am worthless. I am also, yeah.
Yes.
Is this why you decided to go into film? Have you a mission and a message?
Yes, this is really one of the reasons I started to make films, because I thought that that nobody else had seen this in our culture. My culture, the Lap culture, is one of the most filmed cultures in the world. When cinema was invented, when the camera, a film camera was invented, one of the first people to be filmed was the Laps. We have films about the Laps as early as 1895. And if you look at the archives today, you can see fantastic footage about the Laps, but there are very few stories made by my people themselves, and I think most of the films have missed the point. Instead of seeing us as human beings, they have been looking at us as some kind of exotic, I don't know what, but as exotic people to show. And I decided to start to do films because I, from my point of view, the films that has been made before was not very good. Mm-hmm. And since then, I have also, of course, done a lot of films about other topics. But still, I think my films about the Sami culture is maybe one of the most important work I have been done personally.
Closest to your heart.
Yes.
So that the audience will know as well. Paul Sima is employed by the Swedish National Broadcasting Corporation.
Also, sorry, that's not right.
Is this past tense?
That's past. I have
been.
Oh,
you tell me, please. Yeah.
Today I'm working as a freelance film director. Mm-hmm. I have been writing cinema scripts for different studios for 2 years now, and I have also been directing documentary films and also short films. Last week I was in Copenhagen on an international on a Nordic film festival with a film called Let's Dance, and it's a short film on 20 minutes, and it won one of the prizes there. So just before I came here, I was screening this film in Denmark.
What a pleasure, too.
Yeah, it was very funny.
I understand Let's Dance is about a 12-year-old boy who goes to a dance. Tell us more.
It's a comedy. I have a friend who is a reindeer herder. He's about 50 years now. I was once following him on the tundra, and we were herding reindeers. And when we were making fire and drinking coffee, he started to tell me this very funny story about how he went to a dance hall as a 12-year-old boy, and what happened to him when he came there. He saw a very beautiful girl, and of course he felt in love, and yeah. All this very funny and a little bit stupid things he did on this in this place was very funny and very. It was a very visual story, and I decided when we started to walk again that this should really be a film.
When you make a film, how do you determine its length? Is it because it takes 20 minutes to tell the story, or it takes 40 minutes to tell the story?
It can be different reasons. Sometimes a producer asks me if I could make a 20-minute piece for young people as this film. I was asked by the Swedish Film Institute to make a short film for young people. And then I thought this is a good topic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I write a script, and when I have finished the script, the length of the script decides how long the film is going to be.
But sure. Sometimes the music defines the lyrics, and sometimes the lyrics defines the music.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to ask you some questions about film in the world. When I was thinking about what I'd like most to talk to you about, I'm an American person, and so I see and think about mostly American films. As I mentioned earlier, our films are very commercial, very oriented to entertainment, usually oriented to action of some sort. Is that how you perceive our industry, which must also be an industry that captures your attention? It's so large and wealthy.
Yes.
Do you perceive this industry as a healthy one or not so healthy for the world that views it?
I think American films and filmmaking, it's of very high quality. I think if it wasn't, then the films wouldn't be viewed as much as they are around the world. But I think maybe most of the films that are distributed all around the world are not very good. I think a lot of films are made without the people who make them. They have nothing to tell. They have nothing to give to the audience. The only reason they do the films is to make money. And these films are made in a way that they are very predictable. When you see the first 5 or 10 minutes, you can tell how the end of the film is, and they are made in a way that every film is made in the same way. So I believe that the audience might be even dumber when they go out from the cinema than they were before they went in,
and certainly not challenged while they're in the film.
No, and I think this is majority of American films are like this, but there are also very good films. I think there are also very fantastic American films.
Who's doing the best work from your perspective, or what films are signify best work in your mind?
I think Scorsese is one of the best American filmmakers. And I could mention others, but there are very many good American filmmakers. But there is a big difference between European filmmaking, or I could say Scandinavian filmmaking and American filmmaking. In Scandinavia, a lot of films are made by an auteur, by one person who is writing the script, who is also directing. And in Scandinavia, the director and the script writer has very big influence. For example, the producer can't cut my films. I decide every cut, and I decide the length. And the producer's position is not as strong as in America. And I think this is the reason why European films are more personal, and the director and the script writer has more often something to give, some personal, very important experience, while films in America are often made like they were done in a factory.
Yeah, yeah. And the theme, the message, the story may not as be as important as the product, as we say in the United States.
Yes.
Are there major Nordic themes that you can point to in films, or is it a broad range?
I think there are some Nordic themes. Like, I think one of the important themes are the relationship between man and nature, and I think this is very easy to understand it, because the Nordic countries are one of the most we are very few people living in a very big land, and still today the nature isn't destroyed. So, for example, people living in Oslo, the capital of Norway, they can take the if you are there in May, you see a lot of people with skis on their back in the middle of the center of the town, and they take the tram just to the end station and they go skiing. And there are fantastic, for example, in summer you can have your sailing boat in the center of the town, and it takes you 30 minutes to sail out, and you are outside the town. And I think this is one of the very few parts in the world, maybe except Alaska, where you are so close to the nature, even if you are living in a modern society.
And its treatment in film? I assume it cannot just simply be backdrop.
I think this is also in film, a lot of directors are trying to experience or trying to discover how our modern society is destroying the nature. We have been there in Sweden, there have been several important films about, let's say, how the nature is destroyed and how the industry is destroying the film. And there is a huge discussion now in all Nordic countries about how the nature should be preserved, how our societies should be in the future, if we should try to get our living standard higher and higher, if it's important to have three or four cars, if it's important to have a very big house, or if it's more important for the quality of life to have the ability to drink clean water from the river or to go out in the forest and to have clean air.
The Scandinavian countries are also, even if they have relatively small population and large space, there are a number of cultures gathered very close together. Is the coexistence and the workings of several cultural groups also something that you find in Nordic film as a theme?
Let's think. I don't think it's a major theme. If you see the Scandinavian countries, I think the Scandinavian countries are Sweden, Norway, Finland, Iceland. But there are also more Scandinavian cultures. It's like the Faroe Islands, Greenland, and the Sami culture. So there are seven different cultures. But there is one major difference between the Scandinavian countries. The country I'm from, Sweden, is traditionally a colonial power in that area. So, for example, Norway, Finland has been 100 years ago, they were colonies of Sweden, and they have been fighting for their cultures, for their language.
Yeah.
And they have liberated themselves from Sweden. And there is a very big difference in the culture between these countries, because in Norway and Finland, the people there, they really understand the importance of culture. They really understand the importance of having a literary tradition in their own language. While in Sweden, as a country, Sweden has never been suppressed by other of other countries or cultures. So this is my own personal view. I don't think Swedes doesn't understand how important it is.
Perhaps because they see themselves as the center of the universe?
Yes.
Americans fall victim to
this. Yes,
yes. We are it, so we don't bother to think about preserving ourselves.
Yes.
Very strange attitude.
I read a very funny interview in one of the major Swedish newspapers with the ambassador, the U.S. ambassador in Stockholm some years ago, and he was asked what he thought about Sweden. He has been living in Sweden for 1 year, and he said that everything is okay, he feels like home, because Sweden is one of the most Americanized countries in the world. And the journalist asked him, what is the second most Americanized country in the world? And the ambassador, who was a very humoristic man, he said, United States of America.
Very nice.
Yeah, it's funny, yeah.
How is it for a Sami person to live in Sweden? If the Swedish culture sees itself as the center, and your culture is very much in yourself, do you sometimes feel like an exile, or is that too great a name?
Maybe not in exile, but I believe that it has been easier for the Samis or the Lapps who are in Norway or in Finland to get the understanding from the majority. In Finland, the Lapps are a very small number of people, just 5,000 people. But I believe that they have a very good coexistence between the Swedes and the Finns. And the Finnish, the Finns are also relatives to the Samis. We belong to the Finno-Ugrian language group. So the language, the Sami language and the Finnish language is very close, and the culture is very close. And in Norway, it has also been, I think, quite good relationships. We have, for example, in Norway, the Samis have a Sami own parliament, we have like a self-government in the areas where the Samis are in majority. So this parliament decides over cultural and educational questions. While in Sweden, it has been more difficult. Sweden is, a lot of the things happens first in Norway and Finland, and Sweden follows this some years later.
This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis. We're talking with Paul Anders Sima, a filmmaker from Sweden, who is a Sami. I think the question I was thinking of is one that is more emotional than political. When I have been in a different culture, I feel my culture being very much with me, and yet I am watching people who do not look like me, who do not really speak my language, who do not think my thoughts or think in the range of thoughts that I do, and it goes the gamut. I eat different foods and sleep on different beds. This has affected my psyche when I'm there, and you have been in Sweden a long time, but I'm wondering if it has also worked on your emotional self.
Yes, I think it has. About 2 years ago, I went to Finland, to an area where there are also Samis, and I have before going there, I have always seen the relationships between the Samis and the Swedes as suppressor and suppressed. Mm. And I went to this village in Finland, and there are also some other Sami group, minority groups that are minorities, speaking minority Sami languages. And when I came there, I had some friends I trust a lot, and that I think they are very good and bright people. And we went out to a restaurant, and at that restaurant we met some Sami people from the other Sami tribes, and it was a shocking experience to see how my friends from that area, how they treated these Samis belonging to the Skald tribe, as they were like people of no value to them. And I discovered in that area, I stayed there for 2 months, that there was a hierarchy on the place. It was like the Finns were in the top, the Samis, the central Samis that my group is called, came after the Finns, or was under the Finns, and after them was the Skald Sami group. And it's quite interesting to see that even if you are suppressed, you always need to find another group to suppress.
Find another, yes.
And I don't know. I believe that even the Skolds, there must be maybe a minority groups inside that group that is also suppressed. And after that, I have really tried to study relationships between different cultures wherever I happened to travel in the world. And I have seen that almost everywhere where you go, you can see this. I guess the anthropologist called it structural fascism. That every group has to have someone else to pick on who is smaller. And this is human nature in some way. I don't know why we are like this, but...
The Sami people are, by the nature of their environment, bilingual and bicultural for the most part.
Yes.
Samis in Finland speak Finnish and Sweden speak Swedish, as well as their own language group. And that makes them also bicultural. Is your sense that strengthens or disrupts the Sami culture?
I'm very sure that it doesn't disrupt. I think that having two languages means that you have two ways of looking on things. You can, if you get a problem, you can see it from two point of views, and that gives you a lot of more possibilities to handle the problems you have. When I meet people who are bicultural, I think that they are much more, they have a bigger ability to adjust to different cultures and different situations. And as a filmmaker, and I have also been a journalist, it has been of a very big value for me to be able to see the world from different point of views.
Again, this is Paul Anders Sima. He was the first Sami to go to film school in Sweden, created the first film in the Sami language. It was called Beyond Day and Night. Came out in 1987 to great critical acclaim and won several awards at international film festivals when it came out. His latest film is a 20-minute short called Let's Dance, about a 12-year-old boy who goes to a dance and does just that. And he has just told us in this hour that it also has won an award in Copenhagen.
Yes,
in Copenhagen. I'm wondering whether you think that the Swedish culture or the Finnish culture, maybe it's something of a disadvantage compared to the Sami culture, because those people may not be bicultural, may not be bilingual,
yes,
don't have that dual perspective with,
yes,
which to see the world.
I think that's in the world that we are living today. I wouldn't like to be just just to have one language, because then you are trapped in just in your own culture, and you don't have the ability to see see the things you meet in life from two point of views, and in today in Europe we are forming a European community, so I think it's very important to have two cultures, and I think this will give the Samis and also other groups in Europe who are bicultural a very big advance.
Mm.
And this might also be a difference between Europe and America. In Europe, in most of the countries in Europe, there are different languages. There is not just one language. Like in France, there is also minority languages, like in Brittany, the Basques and Corsica, and in most of the European countries there are several languages. So this is not a very unique thing to have two languages.
And perhaps in a world that seems to be shrinking, I wonder if the word village isn't more and more apt for us as a globe of cultures. It seems even more important to have what you call that bicultural view. Your country, people may know and may not know, what has been called Lapland dips in and out of the Kola, K-O-L-A Peninsula,
yes,
which is part of whatever we're calling the USSR these days,
yes.
Finland, Sweden, and Norway, and lies in the upper area of each of those countries, 400 or so kilometers, 250 miles north of the Arctic Circle. It seems to me in my readings before you and I sat down that the effects of the nuclear power plant disruption in Chernobyl,
yes,
must have an effect on your people, on the people of Lapland, as well as hydroelectric dams which are built on your waters and forest logging is the word, logging that is done on your forests. Is in some ways modern day industrial culture encroaching, and are the Samis able to integrate in, or finding this encroachment being overwhelming?
Yes, I think in the last 100 years there has been a very big change in the life of the Samis. When I spoke with my grandfather, when he was young, there were almost no Swedes in our area. And the main way of living was reindeer herding, fishing, and other hunting and other lifestyles that were very close to the nature. I myself, I'm one of the first persons in my culture that has learned to walk on a wooden floor, and I've been at Swedish schools. I've been living in towns. So it's the generation gap is very big. And nowadays, it is very difficult to live in the old ways because there is not enough space for the reindeer herding, and not enough grazing grounds, and the people have to adjust to a new way of life. Earlier, when the colonialization of Sami land started, the Samis could always survive by moving further and further north, because the other people who came, they couldn't manage to live in a very extreme and very cold environment. But now we have reached the Atlantic Sea, so we can't go further. And now I think we have to have another tactics to survive.
What do you think those will be?
I think first of all, we are not the Sami people. We don't belong to the museums. We are not a people that are ready to be placed in museums. And I think you can already see today that the Sami culture has been adjusting very fast to the new environment there. The reindeer herding has been changed and is using modern techniques and has been taking advantage of the new inventions that has come. We are using snowmobiles, we are using helicopters, and the traditional ways of life has been changed in a very positive way to the new life we have. And now we also have a lot of young Samis who are going to universities like this to study medicine, to study journalism, to study filmmaking, and very fast, I think in one generation the Sami people has made or taken the same leap as mm-hmm. as it has taken very many hundreds of years for other European people to take. So I believe that you could almost say that 100 or 200 years ago we were almost Stone Age people, and today there are some guys working with computers and directing the reindeer herds and planning the reindeer herding with computers.
Indigenous peoples in Alaska, elsewhere in the United States and in Canada are at the point where they are both having difficulty and coming to the realization that they must also have a political voice in the government and the power structure of their countries. Is this something that is also happening among the Sami people?
Yes, of course. It's almost in every field you can see similarities between Alaska and Scandinavia. And in fact, the indigenous people in Alaska and in Scandinavia, they belong to, we have a common organization called World Council of Indigenous People, and we try to work together and support each other in the different countries, and also learn from the other indigenous groups, how did they cope and how did they succeed in their part of the world. So I believe this is very important, and the problems for the indigenous people are the same all around the world, not only in the Arctic, but you can also see the same problems in Australia, in New Zealand, and many places around the world.
Do you find in your knowledge of this area of life that meetings of indigenous people are smooth because of the ties that bind, the similar problems and the similar relationship each has to a larger culture? Or do you find that so many distinct groups also speak out of a sufficient number of identities to create blocks and problems with each other?
I could tell you about one experience I had in Fairbanks last time I was here. I was in Fairbanks 1 year ago. I came here because there was a conference in Anchorage and I wanted to see some of Alaska, so I came here. And I met the Indian medicine man here in Fairbanks called Howard Luke.
Mm-hmm.
And I went to his camp and I spoke with him, and it was a fantastic meeting. And I think it was almost like coming home to meet one of our medicine people, and I don't know what the reason is. Maybe the nature has made the indigenous people to think and act in the same way. I think the way we were talking was very Lapish, but he was an Athabascan Indian.
And he would think the way you were talking was very Athabascan.
Yes. I think so. I think so. So I think there are, maybe people who have been living or who are living very close to nature have some similar ways of speaking. He told me that when he speaks, he doesn't describe everything very as much as Americans do, because he expects the person who listens to think, and this is also our way of speaking. It's considered to be rude to explain too much. So I thought it was a very, very nice experience I had in Fairbanks, and I think you should be very proud that you still have people like Howard Luke.
Yes, indeed. This is Conversations, and you're listening to Paul Sima. I'm Susan McGinnis. Let's return to film, if we can, and to themes you want to explore in particular in the future. What's in your mind now?
I'm going to do, when I arrive to Finland, I'm going to start to do a documentary film about the nomadism, about reindeer herding, about people who move from a place to place. And I would like to make this film to show that the people who are nomads, that this is not only a way of living, it's not only a profession, it's also a way of thinking, it's an ideology. And I think a lot of the thoughts and a lot of the philosophy that is behind nomadism would be very important to document, so it doesn't disappear. Today we only have, in Scandinavia, there are only maybe 50 or 60 people living in this traditional way. So I would like to make a one-hour documentary about this group.
And what is it about the way of thinking that compels you?
As I told earlier, I have been thinking a lot of why my people could survive in the Arctic extreme north so long before other peoples could do the same. So I think one of the important things about the nomads are that they are seeing themselves as a part of nature, not the masters of the nature, but as a part of the nature. And they are also seeing the nature alive. They one of the things they told me, the reindeer herders, that I have already started to film, that you and that cloud on the heaven, you are the same. And I thought, no, I can't be a part of the cloud. And he said, oh, of course you can, because in the cloud there is rain, and it rains and it comes to the river and you drink the water. So it's just a question of time when you become a part of the cloud. And if you poison the water, or if you destroy the air, then you are also destroying yourself. So this is one of the reasons I think nomadism is maybe a superior way of thinking than the very short-minded thinking of the modern man. I think in most countries or most cultures we would need some of the nomadistic way of thinking to survive on this globe.
Do you think, as fast as modern cultures are working today, that we can reacquire that foresight, that long-range thinking? I remember listening to a native friend of mine who said, my people think 9 generations ahead when they make a decision. And I thought, most people in American culture think 20 minutes, 5 years if they're making an investment, years rather than generations.
Yes.
Do you think we can reacquire that? Is that possible?
I think we have to. I think that's the only way to survive. I think if we don't do it, then we can see what happens. So I think we don't do things that we are not forced to, but I think we will be forced to be thinking longer and longer to the future.
Is film, in your mind, an educational and a persuasive tool in that way, to say you must think of yourself as the cloud?
No, I don't think so. I really don't think that I can learn people very much with the films. I think I can show them some interesting things, and make people interested in different topics, and then they have to learn themselves. Yeah. But I don't think that you can learn someone something they don't want to have. I think they have you can awaken people's interest in different things, and you can change attitudes. But I don't believe film isn't a media where you can learn mm-hmm. people a lot.
Mm-hmm. It can be part of the murmuring, though. We
yes.
may read it in a magazine. The child may come home and say, "This is what I learned at school today." The film we see in the evening may say it, and it has always seemed to me that as the level of murmuring gets more and more focused on a topic, then a culture can change.
Yes.
Yeah.
But I don't think one film can change very much, but it can be a part of a change.
You have in your work as a filmmaker and a filmmaker and a scriptwriter, you shall tell me if this is correct, maybe it was with the National Broadcasting Corporation, done children's television series.
Yeah, that's true.
I know what a television series looks like on American TV. What does a television series look like on Swedish TV for kids?
There are, of course, very many similarities. But I think one of the differences between children's television or television in general in America and in the Nordic countries or in Scandinavian countries are that our programs are longer. I think people can talk longer and there is also a possibility of explaining more complicated things because you have more time. People have a bigger ability to concentrate on what is on the screen, and still in Scandinavia this is changing very fast. I have been 2 years ago I stayed in a family in Minnesota, and I was very surprised in their way of looking at TV. It was a new experience for me. They had 15 channels, and they had a remote control, and we were looking at TV together, and when I thought that I started to understand something in a TV program, they changed to the next channel, and then I thought, oh, what is this? And then I started to understand what the red thread was in the story or in the TV program, and then they changed to the next channel, and I was shocked again, and the whole night we were looking on 15 channels, and it was like getting 15 different stories in the head all the time, and it was very, very strange experience in the first time. And I also believe that, or I also saw that people are very affected by this TV way of telling. In when I met people, they were like, in our country, when you talk, you can take time, you can tell a story, and the other person is listening. But I experienced that it was like looking at TV, that sometimes mm-hmm. the person you were talking, like, he pushed on the second channel and started to talk about something else, and then when you came into that theme, then they were changing topics again, and I think this is the impact of TV all around the world. This is also happening in Scandinavia, but still today we have a living oral tradition in many places in Scandinavia. It's possible to talk. It's possible to make a TV show if you have a good storyteller with only one image for 30 minutes, and people will listen. I had a American friend, a TV producer, who visited me in Norway when I was living there some years ago, and he asked me. He said that he wanted to look at TV on prime time at 8 o'clock. And we saw a TV program. It was about a man sitting in a boat, fishing, and telling his very private philosophies of life at prime time. And he said, "Let's see what's on the other channel." And I of course, there is only one channel in Norway, so I pushed on the other buttons, and there was like this war of the ants.
Snow
on the screen. Yeah. And he was looking. Okay, let's see on the next. Oh, same program. And he said that. I think it was. It also opened my eyes. I think this is. First, I was ashamed, but I'm now a little bit proud. I think it's very important to not destroy this ability you have in a people to concentrate, to listen. Mm-hmm. But of course, I think it's. It's changing very fast, and we are going to, in 10 or 20 years, maybe the people in Scandinavia, they can't concentrate in more than 20 seconds.
Do you think the exportation of the American entertainment product is so strong then that we simply dominate?
Yes, it is. It is too strong. And you can see all around the world, and in Europe you can see it very clear that there are several countries that have decided that they don't allow more than, let's say, 30% of the total broadcasting time as American airtime. They have decided that they would like to have other mm-hmm. films and TV programs also from other cultures.
I hadn't heard that, and it certainly would be a way to both preserve the internal integrity and to thwart this moving monolith. I was aware of concerns in Canada, which is, of course, just right across our border, where they buy, rent, view a great deal of our entertainment offering, and still, while buying it, have great concerns that the Canadians' own offerings are being reduced because of the amount of time being taken up on our screen. Or by our screenings.
Mm. That's true, and it's. I think it would be important to have some European programming in America, but it's very hard to find any of that in America. I think the public TV in America is really fantastic. I have seen very many good programs on public TV.
Yeah, it is the strongest, and we not only have imports from Europe, but it seems that the best of what is made by American producers for television is on public television. Once again, we're talking with Paul Simon. Do you see the influence of Ingmar Bergman on Swedish film yet today? He certainly is the strongest voice recognized on this side of the ocean in Swedish film.
Yes, I think he has a very strong impact still today, because I think he's one of the founders of this production system that we are having, where the director has a very big role. I think Ingmar Bergman has always been writing his scripts himself. He has always been editing his films himself. And there has never been a producer who has decided that he should end the story in a certain way.
Mm-hmm.
So I think he has a very big impact.
He also has a, certainly when compared to American film, a slower technique within the movie, more focused. As you describe Swedish television, which is what made me think of it, he spends more time on one thing, whether it is coming into a room or the face or the view out the window, and also spends more time on emotions and motive and the like. Is that also reflected, as far as you can say?
Yes, I think so. I think this is a part of the Scandinavian cultures, and I think Ingmar Bergman has just been showing this from Scandinavian life. So I think this is.
It is not the man, it is the culture.
Yeah, I think this is the cultural impact on him.
Paul Simon, I want to thank you for spending an hour on Conversations. Let me say that Paul has been here to lecture and participate in events of the Nordic Arts Conference this fall 1991. The conference was jointly sponsored by the University of Alaska Fairbanks, by the Danish Writers Association, and by the Danish Arts Council. I'm Susan McGinnis, with me Paul Simon. I hope you'll join us again next week.